This is Ozarks at Large for a snowy and cold Monday. It's February 13th, 2012, and I'm Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar. Ahead on today's show, the Northwest Arkansas chapter of Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families prepares to raise some money and serve some soup. We'll also hear from Ozarks at Large's Sophie Kidd in a new series called Music Matters. But first, a dozen home healthcare agency franchises operate in our region, along with several hospital-based agencies. The Arkansas Department of Health provides in-home healthcare as well. And as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the Medicare and Medicaid-dependent industry faces both regulatory and financial challenges.
According to the U.S. Department of Labor, since 2008, the in-home health care sector is projected to double by 2018. Trained home health care nurses deliver affordable medical assistance and personal care to an estimated 8 million sick, injured, frail elders, and terminally ill at a cost of $60 billion. Nancy Elphingstone is executive director of the Home Care Association of Arkansas. Elphingstone says Arkansas has 172 Medicare-certified home health agencies.
And in any given year, these agencies will see anywhere from 60 to 80,000 patients total for the state. We do keep that data and are comfortable with that. And certainly, these agencies go into the home and they let these patients be able to be helped at home rather than having to go into a more restrictive environment, the hospital, et cetera.
She says that the industry is burgeoning in the face of ongoing medical entitlement cuts. Medicaid and Medicare cover 75% of home care costs nationwide.
And certainly our agencies in Arkansas have felt that. Most of our agencies operate at a very slim margin. Especially on just if you just look at the Medicare side of it. In fact, I have some figures from our national association that states that with addition of more cuts that were proposed some time ago, that 55.8% of the agencies in Arkansas would be operating at zero or less margins.
By law, home health care must be ordered through a patient's physician. But under a new Medicare rule, which came into force late last year, patients must do so within a strict time frame.
To prove that they have seen their physician either a certain amount of time prior to enrollment in home health or upon enrollment. And that is the change that is really put a lot of additional stress on home health agencies and on physicians' offices.
And Nancy Elphingstone says the new rules will help to prevent abuse to the system.
Policies like this have been put into place to make sure a home health agency isn't putting someone on service and getting a doctor to sign off on it and when they really may not have needed home care at that point. Again, I want to emphasize there's been no suspicion of that happening in Arkansas.
Another policy which the U.S. Department of Labor is addressing is the fact that many in-home caregivers are underpaid and overworked. Most, it says, earn less than minimum wage and no overtime. That's because, as, quote, companion workers, they've long remained exempt from federal labor protections. In late December, the Obama administration pushed to revise the Fair Labor Standards Act rule to ensure fair pay for an estimated 2 million in-home caregivers. Of those, more than 92% are women, 50% minority, and nearly 40% have to resort to Medicaid and food stamps. Although Nancy Elphingstone could not comment on how this will affect home care workers in Arkansas, Lee Davis is concerned. He operates ElDirect, an independent in-home elder care agency, with offices in Washington County, Fort Smith, and Conway.
We carry a large caseload of Medicaid, so we do see the huge need that's out there. I mean, there's people right now that we're serving right now that live in a storage shed, literally. So we see kind of the suffering that happens with seniors that are just forgotten about. Other side of that coin is we work with veterans, we work with private payer, self-pay, and then long-term care insurance. That's kind of the four primary pay sources that exist today.
Davis employs 148 CNAs and RNs in Northwest Arkansas who work by the hour and are paid above minimum wage. So if his agency is forced under the proposed new federal rule to pay overtime, that cost, he said, will be passed on to clients.
Most clients can't afford time and a half. They can't afford to pay an extra additional amount because some clients need 24/7 care. And with this mandate, it would put a lot of clients, I don't know what it would do to the clients. I mean, they would just wouldn't be able to afford it. It would make us, we would just have to charge more or else we'd go out of business.
Lee Davis says some staff choose to work extra hours for extra income. Karen Coolidge is an in-home service nurse for the Carroll County Unit of the Arkansas Department of Health. She and her staff follow patients, elders, moms, and newborns released from hospitals into their homes where they oversee care.
And what we try to do as in-home service nurses is just make up the gap that can exist when a person leaves a facility and returns home with all this stuff that they may or may not know how to deal with.
The Arkansas Department of Health operates 94 local health units across 75 state counties. Staff treat chronic and infectious disease, deliver health care to low-income women and children, assist with Medicaid and Our Kids services, and provide in-home health care. Karen Coolidge says she's comfortable working for the state health care agency and has enjoyed job security.
The pay is not as good, maybe, as in the private sector, but they do provide opportunity for our education, being able to advance.
But she and her colleagues are aware of ongoing financial pressures the department is under.
But recently, since they have, you know, all the budget cuts have come to the forefront, I don't know if I have that security as much as I used to.
Marcy Gibson is branch chief for in-home services of the Arkansas Department of Health. She oversees 625 employees with an additional 2,500 contract workers. ADH staff receive minimum wage and are paid overtime, so won't be affected by the proposed federal ruling.
Well, under the umbrella of in-home services, we provide an array of physician-ordered medical services in the home. We do home health, which is our skilled nursing program. We provide hospice for the terminally ill. We provide personal care and elder choices, which is really a long-term care program that assists patients with activities of daily living.
On average, the in-home division works with 26,000 patients a year, 90% of that care delivered in rural Arkansas.
We have, percentage-wise, 65.5% of our revenue comes from Medicaid, 28.9% from Medicare, and 5.2% from third-party insurers, private insurance, the VA, those sorts of insurers. We do a large Medicaid. We see a lot of Medicaid patients, both in our personal care elder choice program, our MIP, and in our own home health program. And part of that, I'm sure, is because we are so strong in rural Arkansas.
And with so many medically entitled, ADH, like other state health providers, is feeling the strain.
Basically, each year for the past six, we have had a reduction in what we are paid to provide that care. In addition to those rate cuts in Medicare home health specifically, we have had several regulatory requirements that basically add cost to the service that you're not reimbursed for. And it's caught up with us. I mean, we are now at a point that it is costing more to provide the care than we're being paid. And home health, like most of health care, is very labor intensive. And home health is by definition a traveling program. So you are incurring travel costs to get to the patient's home, and it requires a nurse, an aide, a physical therapist, whatever the patient requires. Those are, you know, that's very labor intensive. And we had reached the point that these cuts really had an impact on our bottom line. In addition to that, as the public agency, we are the safety net for many, many Arkansans that either have no health insurance or are not covered by Medicare or Medicaid. And we do roughly $1.5 million worth of no-source care a year.
To meet its budget, the division will reportedly do things like institute furloughs without pay and reduce mileage reimbursements, at least through June 30th.
And at that time, we hope we have stabilized our program, and we will have some other efficiencies in place that will take us into the next fiscal year.
Marcy Gibson says all state agencies are tightening their belts and are waiting to see what will happen under health care reform, along with delivering affordable insurance benefits via state marketplaces to the uninsured, underinsured, and even those with pre-existing conditions. The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act will create a national long-term care insurance program for those who pay nominally monthly premiums for 5 years. Reducing the Medicaid role, the new law will also strengthen Medicare by fighting waste, fraud, and abuse, while extending the life of the Medicare Trust Fund 2029. These changes will create a safer and more secure home health care complex. Arkansas Department of Health In-Home Service Branch Chief Marcy Gibson.
You know, these are very important services, and we are very committed to our clients, and we're going to do everything we can to continue to meet the needs of our Kansans that choose to come to us.
But how agencies, both public and private, forced to lay off workers and limit hours, will serve growing client and patient demand remains to be seen. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
To submit your comment and learn more about changes in the nation's home health care system, visit regulations.gov. The Arkansas Department of Health's in-home health care can be found at healthy.arkansas.gov via the Programs and Services link. The Home Care Association of Arkansas is at arhomehealth.org. Another resource, especially for elders in need of skilled home care, is thecaresupport.com. This is Ozarks at Large. The last week has mostly been positive for business news in the state of Arkansas. Roby Brock from our content partner TalkBusiness.net has an update.
I'm Roby Brock with your Talk Business Update, a recap of the biggest business and political stories of the last week. Governor Mike Beebe said Arkansas was competing for a new Caterpillar hydraulic excavator manufacturing operation that could employ up to 1,400 workers. In a midweek interview, the governor said Fort Smith was one possible location for the plant due to the region's available manufacturing workforce. Beebe said the state is not promoting any one city, but will work to present options in Arkansas that best meet Caterpillar's requirements. Caterpillar has a large motor grader manufacturing factory in North Little Rock. After 16 months of investigation and several months of negotiations, federal and state regulators announced a landmark settlement with five of the nation's largest banks regarding abuses in the mortgage servicing industry. Arkansas Attorney General Dustin McDaniel joined his state counterparts and federal officials with the U.S. Department of Justice in announcing a $26 billion agreement that will bring close to $40 million to Arkansas. The agreement provides direct financial relief to Arkansas consumers at risk of losing their homes to foreclosure and to those who currently owe more than their property's worth. Representatives of the powerful Northwest Arkansas Council and the influential economic development arm of the Little Rock Regional Chamber of Commerce, known as 50 for the Future, will meet in Fayetteville next Thursday and Friday for a working session, regional tour, and evening dinner. On Thursday afternoon, February 16th, the Little Rock Group will tour the new Crystal Bridges Museum with Northwest Arkansas influentials. On Friday, leaders from the two regional groups will convene for private working sessions to hash out a direction for their efforts and to lay the groundwork for future cooperation. Between 200 and 300 jobs could come back to Fort Smith if attorney and land buyer David Harp, Union Pacific, and the Fort Chaffee Redevelopment Authority can work out a deal soon. Local developers are heading to Omaha later this month to negotiate the possibility of Union Pacific installing a transloading facility at Chaffee Crossing near Fort Smith. Walmart plans to spend $750 million in Canada to complete at least 73 projects this year. The investment comes a full year ahead of its discount competitor Target, who recently announced its entry into Canada with 24 new stores by the spring of 2013. The 73 projects on tap for this year will include building new stores and expanding, remodeling, or relocating existing stores, according to Walmart's press release. Axiom says it's looking to bring on hundreds of new tech workers as the Little Rock-based data and digital marketer adds a greater emphasis to its digital media strategies. Scores of those jobs could be in Arkansas, but Axiom is also likely to recruit nationwide and worldwide in some instances. Lost accounts, both purposeful and not on purpose, set back fourth quarter and full year results for Van Buren-based USA Truck. The dry goods trucking firm posted a fourth quarter loss of $4.4 million on declining revenues of $126 million. 1 year ago, USA Truck recorded a loss of $1.8 million for the same quarter of 2010 on revenue of $122 million. For the full year, USA Truck tallied $10.78 million in losses on revenue of $519 million. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Update.
This is Ozarks at Large, and I'm Iti Agnihotri Madhokar. The Northwest Arkansas chapter of Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families is getting ready to host Soup Sunday, its biggest fundraiser. The evening involves, well, soup, bread, lots of dessert, and music. And the money raised goes toward the nonprofit's advocacy efforts. Last week, I spoke with Laura Kellums, the director of Northwest Arkansas Chapter of Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, to learn more about the fundraiser and the nonprofit itself.
We are an organization that has actually been around since 1977, based in Little Rock, and we opened an office here in 2008. And we work on behalf of our state's kids in poverty, foster children, kids in the juvenile justice system. But we work to create policy change and change state laws on their behalf rather than directly serving them through hospitals or shelters. We work to change state policy. Okay. And we've done that for almost 35 years.
Okay. So what are some of the specific goals and missions that you've been working on recently?
Sure. We are always working to improve health access for children throughout the state, and we have a special emphasis on that here in Northwest Arkansas of late. We are working right now to ensure that we have more community-based juvenile justice system rather than incarcerating more kids who are accused of crimes. We want more services in the community, so we basically imprison fewer kids. And juvenile judges throughout the state are working with us to help us accomplish that. We are always working to get more access to pre-K services for our lowest income kids in the state, and that includes some children of immigrants here in Northwest Arkansas who we know need more help to get ready for that first day of kindergarten so they can succeed just like all the other kids in their classes. A little background on the reason that we do this work is that it matters to a child. Poverty actually matters to their success. Hmm. So it makes sense if you think about it. A child in poverty is going to statistically have less chance of success than a middle-income child or higher-income child. Okay. And it's not anything that their parents are doing wrong or that anything wrong with their family. It's just that across the board, statistically, they're going to have not as strong a chance of being able to read on time, mm-hmm. of graduating from high school. They're going to have an increased risk of ending up in prison or becoming a victim of a crime themselves statistically. So we start at that base level and we say, what can we do as the state of Arkansas or the Northwest Arkansas region to increase their chances of success, to sort of even that playing field, or as we say, close the achievement gap? So we know that healthier children learn better, mm-hmm. and children who aren't hungry learn better, and children who have a little bit of instruction in, say, the English language before they go into kindergarten are going to have so much better chance of success. So that's where we start, and we try to work with organizations and the state legislature and the governor's office and as many people as will listen to us in the ways that we can invest in those kids to ensure their success. Our philosophy is that we can't succeed as a state and become a less impoverished state than we are right now. We can't move our state forward economically unless we ensure that our children succeed. And since we have such a high rate of child poverty in Arkansas, it's one of the worst mm-hmm. rates in the country, we know that we need to take extra steps.
Now, as a nonprofit, mm-hmm. how does the organization fund itself?
We are privately funded, and I actually think that's a really good thing. It gives us our credibility. We are mm-hmm. not a government-funded agency. So when we have a big win, for example, when we helped create ORCIDS First, and tens of thousands of children have had health insurance that way and continue today, we don't actually benefit from that. Getting more funding for more access for kids to get pre-K or for community-based services for juvenile justice, kids in the juvenile justice system, or more caseworkers for foster care. We don't actually benefit in any way from that because we're not a government-funded program, and that gives us our credibility because we're independent. So when we argue that we think something is a good idea and very necessary, no one can argue that it's for our own benefit. It's just because we have done the research and we know that this is what we can do as a state to improve mm-hmm. children's lives. So that said, we are privately funded through foundations and through individual donors. Okay. Here in Northwest Arkansas, we have a heavy emphasis on needing individual donors. We have some bigger foundation grants that are our statewide work. But to have a Northwest Arkansas office here, we have to have lots and lots of individual donors.
And one of the biggest fundraising events that Arkansas Advocates organizes is Soup Sunday that's coming up.
That's right. Soup Sunday, it's February 26th from 4 to 7 mm-hmm. in Springdale at the Northwest Arkansas Convention Center. And we've done this for 11 years here in Northwest Arkansas. And actually, this is one of the oldest organizations fundraisers in the state. They've been doing this for 31 years in Little Rock. And so we've been, this will be our 11th annual Soup Sunday mm-hmm. here in this region. And it's a lot of fun. Families come and sample soups that restaurants from throughout the region have donated. Restaurants come in and serve the soups that they've made, and people pay just $20 for adults to get in and okay. $5 for kids, and they can sample from as many soups as they want. We also have bread donated and dessert. This year we're going to have ice cream sundaes, so that will be a new treat.
Huge plus.
Right. Exactly. Hopefully that'll draw. And we have a lot of great from everyone from restaurants to the bread donors to the Breyers Ice Cream, who actually donates ice cream to us every year, and they're getting toppings from Smucker's. And so we just have a great group of people who come together to ensure that all the proceeds from this event go to support the work that we do here in Northwest Arkansas.
Let's talk about the soup part of the Soup Sunday a little bit.
Sure.
What kind of soups? How many kind of soups?
Oh, gosh, we have all kinds of soups. We try to get our restaurants to have a mix okay. from vegetarian to meaty soups to a couple of gluten-free soups that people have. That's been more of a demand in recent years. Mm-hmm. But we have restaurants that have donated for years and years from Spring Street Grill in Springdale to Cafe Rue Orleans here in Fayetteville, and Common Grounds and the Hog House have donated for years and years. And we have some new ones that have signed on this year okay. That people are probably really interested in. I've heard a lot of talk about Vetro 1925. Yes. It's on Center Street in mm-hmm. Fayetteville. I ate a delicious dinner there, and they are donating soup this year. We also have Bordino's will donate for the first time.
Okay.
Fresco Cafe and Pub, if I got the name right, right here downtown Fayetteville. Fish City Grill and Rogers, and Lindy's Cajun Gypsy, which has been around for years and years. It's over
yes.
on Poplar Street. There's a restaurant called Twin Kitchen in South Fayetteville that's going to donate some
yes.
coconut soup, which I can't wait to taste.
That should be exciting. Yeah.
So we have about, 30 or more soup flavors from more than 25 restaurants, so people can just get a little bit of everything.
Hmm. Now, how many people attend this fundraiser?
We usually have about 500, and we hope that we have that many or more this year.
And how much money are you able to raise?
Last year, we raised more than $40,000, and we hope to match or exceed that this year. We kind of want to make friends at the same time that we raise some money. And it's a good time. I mean, it's really casual. People don't have to get dressed up. They bring their kids.
That's always nice.
Right? Jeans, whatever. It doesn't really matter. And kids come. Everybody brings their kids. It's just $5 for the kids. And there's a little a band, a jazz combo, and they play. Every year they donate all their time to us. And so the kids kind of dance around and have a good time.
And I also heard that you're trying to create no trash this time.
Right. Well, we probably won't be able to achieve absolutely no trash. Mm-hmm. But we are working with a group called Northwest Arkansas Emerging Leaders. And they are helping us recycle and compost the waste from this event. It's because we have a lot of sample cups and people go around and get lots of types of soup. It's more sanitary for us to have disposable items. And we have figured out that just about every single thing that we make and use at this event can be recycled or composted through this great organization. And they're going to help us with volunteers. And so it's a great way to make a good event better by being more sustainable.
So February 26th,
that's right.
Starting 4 p.m.?
4 to 7.
Okay.
And it's at the Convention Center in Springdale. That's right there at 412 and 540.
Mm-hmm. And $20 for adults, $25 at the door.
Yes.
And $5 for kids.
That's correct.
And lots of soup, lots of bread, and lots of desserts. So
people can order tickets now for those that advance price at our website, which is aradvocates.org.
Okay.
And our Springdale number is 479-927-9800, and that way they can order the tickets in advance. But we always welcome everybody to buy them at the door. It's just $5 more.
Okay. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
Laura Killams is the director of the Northwest Arkansas chapter of Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. In full disclosure, she is the wife of KUAF News director Kyle Killams. To find out how children and families without insurance cost taxpayers more money in the long run, visit our website, ozarksatlarge.com.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Times are booming, money's to be made. But the markets changed and the bottom fell out. Credit's dried up and the banks are in doubt.
Taft Falco was born Gus Nelson in Clark County in southwest Arkansas and grew up between Gurdon and Wheeland Springs in the southern part of that county. With his ever-changing band, the Panther Burns, Taft Falco has carved out a name for himself over the decades internationally with a strange brew of showmanship, post-rockabilly, blues, and tangos.
What we did was a kind of roots music through the avant-garde some way. And there was no one else quite doing that. And so we deconstructed. You compose them, you construct them, we deconstruct them.
Early backers and bandmates included Alex Chilton and Little Rock native Jim Dickinson. After relocating to Memphis in the early 1970s, Tav Falco has since made his home in Paris, Vienna, and Buenos Aires, always keeping his Arkansas ties as well. In 2010, Tav Falco and the unapproachable Panther Burns reemerged with their first new album in nearly a decade, Conjurations, Seance for Deranged Lovers, containing a dozen Taft Falco originals. Years in the making, it was recorded in Paris, the one in France, not in Logan County in West Arkansas, and was released by the French label Stag-O-Lee. It is the first ever Panther Burns album of all original compositions.
All day long I've been thinking about you, fantasizing all about you.
Over the years, Taft Falco has burnished his reputation as a boulevardier, filmmaker, photographer, and musician, although he's quick to say he is not a musician, but a performer.
Well, I've done that all the way through, you know. There's really been no separation for me. I mean, it's like Charlie Parker said, the job of the artist is to break down barriers between the arts. And I really don't see, it's the aesthetic that's important. It's not particularly the art form. Anybody can learn to draw or play on a guitar in one way or another. I mean, some people have more technical ability than others. It's the aesthetic that distinguishes the artist.
Your moaning low in the night, whining in the pit of the night, slapping the face to smite, fever 110 Fahrenheit.
With the unapproachable Panther Burns existing in various incarnations for more than three decades, the Arkansas-born creator and leader of the band remains resolute about the Panther Burns aesthetic.
I've worked very, very hard at learning what I can, what little I can do with a musical instrument and with other disciplines. It's not that I'm undisciplined, but there's only so far I can go. I know my limitations technically, and I work within that. And I make the best of it. What I'm concerned with is the undercurrent, the dark waters of the unconscious.
Here in its entirety is Arkansas-er Tav Falco of Wheeland Springs in Clark County in southwest Arkansas with Secret Rendezvous from the 2010 Tav Falco and the Unapproachable Panther Burns album, Conjurations, Seance for Deranged Lovers.
All day long I've been thinking about you, fantasizing all about you, and all the things we're gonna do, right in our secret rendezvous. All I live for in this world, what I'm gonna do to you, girl, dancing on the roof.
Tav Falco from between Gurdon and Wheeland Springs in Clark County in southwest Arkansas with Secret Rendezvous from his 2010 album with the Unapproachable Panther Burns, Conjurations, Seance for Deranged Lovers. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer of Arkansongs is Michael Hiblin. For more information or to subscribe to the podcast, visit arkansongs.org.
It is Monday, February 13th, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Ithi Agnihotri Matholkar, and with me is Becca Bacon-Martin, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Happy Monday.
Happy Monday to you, too.
Have you done your Valentine's Day shopping?
I'm not a big
You're
believer.
Just not.
I'm not
you
a
don't
believer.
Do these things,
I'm
do
not.
You?
I'm sorry.
I've got to come up with something, and I got to do it fast. Maybe baseball tickets. It's almost that time of year.
Probably.
If you need an emergency solution, there's a show called Come Fly Away coming to Fort Smith tonight. It's the choreography of Twyla Tharp and songs made famous by Frank Sinatra. Songs like Luck Be a Lady, Fly Me to the Moon, Body and Soul. Showtime is 7:30 at the Arkansas Best Performing Arts Center at the Fort Smith Convention Center. Mm. And tickets start at $32. Or you can go to a book signing.
Okay.
It's at 3 o'clock today at Northwest Arkansas Community College. It's history professor Chris Huggard's new book, Santa Rita del Cobre, A Copper Mining Community in New Mexico. And books will be for sale. And if you want to plan way ahead for a gift,
okay,
you can audition for No Sex, Please, We're British at 7 o'clock at Rogers Little Theater and take your sweetheart when the show opens.
These are some very interesting ideas, I'd have to say that. Thanks, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is the features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. This is Ozarks at Large, and I'm Iti Agnihotri Madholkar. Today on Ozarks, we begin another series, this time about music. It's called Music Matters. The series will feature a new segment that highlights musical instruments and the artists behind them. Dr. Michael Montgomery is the double bass instructor at the University of Arkansas and the first guest of the series that'll be hosted by Ozarks at Large's Sophie Kidd.
Dark, somber and earthly, resonant, wafting and mighty, sustaining and mellow. These are just a few characteristics of the double bass, which is the largest and lowest pitched member of the violin family in the modern symphony orchestra. The broadness of the timbre possesses great power and represents the essence of the sound of the double bass. It is this element that defines the instrument's principal task in the orchestra, which is to play the fundamental bass line. Dr. Michael Montgomery is the double bass teacher at the University of Arkansas, as well as the bass instructor for the Suzuki Music School. With more than 3,000 performances in his career, including 20 years of work with the Florida Philharmonic Orchestra, he knows his way around the double bass.
I guess it was kind of a fluke. I actually started playing music because some friends of mine wanted to start a band, and I was involved. And they played other instruments, the guitars, which I kind of wanted to play, but nobody was playing bass. So I played the electric bass at that time. And that led to a lot of years of playing in, I guess, what you would call garage bands. And when it was time to go to college, at that time, you couldn't major in jazz or commercial music, so I took up string bass at that time and played in the orchestra at school, and that started my playing the double bass in classical music. I was lucky when I went to school that I was in an area where you could play in orchestras. The students actually played in a lot of orchestras around the area. That was in the middle of Mississippi, and we were able to play Pensacola Symphony, the Mobile Opera, Jackson Opera. I played in Baton Rouge Symphony, the New Orleans Summer Pops. So there was a lot of playing experience for symphony music, and that kind of took over, and I guess the playing the electric bass kind of fell to the wayside at that point. And actually, when I finished college in classical music, string bass, another couple of years I played on the Gulf Coast when there was a lot of nightclubs. I supported myself playing a couple of years in the dance music in the nightclubs with, again, the electric bass.
The bass is a very versatile instrument, and its history has its origins in a faraway period when music was linked to the ordinary and extraordinary events of everyday life. The viola da gamba was one of the predominant instruments of the Renaissance and Baroque periods in Europe. The story behind the bass is riddled with a confusing array of differing construction, sizes, and tuning. In 1542, Silvestro Ganassi developed a bass viola da gamba in Venice, which is often regarded as the ancestor of the double bass. Viola da gamba literally means viola of the leg. Nowadays, the double bass is used in different styles from classical to jazz to bluegrass and rock and roll.
The dates of Bach, which was like 1685 to 1750, at that time, the string family wasn't used so much the way it is now, the way we think of it. The gambas were used a lot. So if you look at scores like of Bach, you'll have a bass part, but it doesn't always mean that it's a double bass, because the gamba family had a lot of different tunings, from high-pitched instruments that were very small to low-pitched instruments like the bass. And the violins came into being. I understand their origins were more from some of the more eastern countries, you know, Arabia. And the gambas were used so in the Baroque period. And our bass, I think, its origins are as much in the gamba family as anything else. So it's almost like we're an extension of that. But if you look at the double bass, it looks like, I'm sure everyone knows what a violin looks like. If you take a violin and you just make it really big, you would have a visual for the double bass, what it is. So it's like the violin in the shape of the body. It's much larger, of course. It's got four strings, and we tune the strings a little more different. And through the years, I think what we call the double bass now has replaced the gamba. Gamba is more of a period instrument now, and people do a lot of period music. That's coming back. So when you see the double bass, you may think of it as being in a jazz group. It's great for the jazz group because when you play with your fingers, it's called pizzicata, as opposed to playing with the bow, which is called arco. In the orchestra, most of the time we play arco with the bow. In the jazz group, you play pizzicato. And Gunther Schuller wrote a really neat history of early jazz and described how the double bass took over from the tuba in those early Dixieland groups. The bass has a really hard articulation on the front end of the note, and it makes it really good for playing the swing period music, four quarter notes to a measure, walking bass lines. The tuba would play the tubi music that's typical of early, probably Dixieland, and that worked fine for those groups, but as they started playing four beats in a measure, the pizzicato articulation worked really well to drive the rhythm section, and that's kind of the foundation of the jazz rhythm. But I think the pizzicato notes on the bass make it really well suited for jazz music.
But what do people actually think of the double bass?
In big cities, maybe in Europe, people make the connection with the orchestra. They see, I've heard it described as a backdrop, both sonically and visually, for the orchestra, a wall of sound behind all the other instruments. And I suppose people in cities where there are orchestras, they make that association. And otherwise, they would see a double bass or string bass, they would think of it playing in a jazz group. Probably a Dixieland group is the visual from movies and what have you, is the string bass in those groups. But things are changing with bass, you know, electric bass and double bass and classical. The dividing lines between the genres, between jazz, between rock, commercial music, and symphony and solo and recital and chamber music, the lines are kind of getting blurred right now. A lot of people are doing a lot of stuff with the instrument that you can't really fit into one of those genres. So it's an exciting time. But I would say yes, and even up here in Arkansas, if people see or imagine the bass, they would probably think of a bluegrass group. Yeah, because of Branson and the Ozarks and everything. So yeah, it's hard to say what people think of when they think of the double bass, but probably a lot of different things. And it is a lot of different things.
From Vivaldi and Mozart to Hindemith and Koussevitzky, all the great composers have written music for this refined instrument that enjoyed a period of popularity during the 18th century. And since then, it has become the ace up the sleeve for almost every genre in music.
All the symphonic music that's been written since the time of Bach would include a bass section in the orchestra. It's, again, my perspective, probably the most important part of the orchestra is the bass section. And so every symphonic piece would have a bass section, the deep tones that even if you don't think that you hear it, it's there. It's a presence that fills out the sonority. In the symphonic repertory, it's a must-have, having the bass in the orchestra. But there's solo repertory, too, sonatas, just like everyone else. In chamber music, we don't have the extensive you know, like the string quartet. They got such a large repertoire from all the major composers. But there's a list, and I found a webpage that lists 3,000 works that are chamber pieces. So there's an extensive chamber music repertory. There's also a lot of solo repertory. I mean, bass players are really active and very, very much out there, you know, knocking on the doors of composers and what have you, getting them to write stuff for us. When I was in Miami, I went down there for graduate school and got my doctorate down there. And I had a wonderful teacher, Lucas Drew, who was pretty well known around the world as a great teacher and ambassador of the bass. And there was an orchestra there, the Florida Philharmonic. I started playing, you know, when I was finishing my degree. And it developed into a really nice job with, you know, a two-week paycheck, annual salary, medical insurance was paid, and pension.
After Miami, Michael Montgomery and his wife Lourdes, who is a prolific church music composer, moved to Fayetteville. And immediately he started teaching college students as well as being interested in the Suzuki Method philosophy.
Each year, little by little, I think I've leaned more towards the teaching and to the point of turning down a lot of gigs just to have myself available to teach. The newest thing about all that, I mean, I'm teaching, you know, college students at the university, and there's excellent string programs in this area, in Rogers and Bentonville especially. There's really good orchestra programs. So there's students that come for extra help in the middle school and high school. What happened more recently, a friend of mine, Chen Yu, teaches violin at the Suzuki School, and he started talking to me about Suzuki, and I became interested and eventually went to Beaver Creek in Colorado and to Houston, Texas, and even down to Argentina to do some of the teacher training and learn about teaching smaller children. Dr. Suzuki had a great love for the teaching, and he, a lot of experience, trial and error, really, is very intuitive. So the methods he came up with for teaching young people, it's actually called the mother tongue method, because he realized for a little child to learn a whole language, nothing could be more difficult. And adults have a big struggle with that. So he examined how do we pick up a language, the correlation between the parent and the child, and just the constant environment of being nurtured.
Dr. Montgomery started the Ozark Mini Bass Project in order to give the opportunity to a new generation of young musicians to experience the beauty of the double bass.
For a family to run out and buy a $1,700 instrument, that's really an expense. And then music lessons can cost $900, $1,000 a year for lessons. So imagine a family saying, oh, I have a little child. I'd like them to learn the double bass. Oh, great. Can you come up with $3,000 real quick? So I spent the first part of the fall going around knocking on doors of businesses and asking them. I've got my five of my little kids are playing in the orchestra that had a tuition, and they underwrote that. So that was good.
To hear more about his project, just go to the KUAF 91.3 website for Ozarks at Large. That was Sophie Kidd Kirmanidu.
Music Matters is a series of segments hosted by Ozarks at Large's Sophie Kidd that'll feature musical instruments and the artists associated with them.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 13th of February, 2012. It's the birthday of the true crime writer William Roughead, born in Edinburgh, Scotland, 1870, a lawyer, loved murder trials, went to see them at the High Court, Edinburgh, which he then wrote up as narratives and published in his book 12 Scots Trials in 1913. Henry James liked his work, so did Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and President Franklin D. Roosevelt reserved a special shelf near the Oval Office just for the books of William Roughead. Despite his dry humor and his irony, Roughead's long study of criminal depravity never turned him pessimistic. He said, "The study of criminology has by no means made me a cynic. It has encouraged my admiration for the ingenuity of the human race." It's the birthday of the painter Grant Wood, near Anamosa, Iowa, 1891, known for the portrait of a farmer and his spinster daughter, American Gothic, which, along with the Mona Lisa, is one of the most familiar paintings in the world. Grant Wood grew up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, went to art school in Minneapolis, then Chicago, went to Europe where he saw the work of Jan van Eyck, the 15th century Flemish painter, and was influenced by it. It was in homage to van Eyck that Wood painted those stylized fields and rolling hills of Iowa, and those lit scenes with long shadows. In a new biography entitled Grant Wood, A Life, R. Tripp Evans presents Wood as a closeted homosexual who adopted Midwestern regionalism as a shield for his own bohemianism, and who, when he died of pancreatic cancer at the age of 50, was planning to leave Iowa and move to California. Here's a poem for today by Jennifer Meyer, entitled Meditation from 14a. And what if the passage out of this life is like a flight from Seattle to St. Louis, the long taxi out of the body, the brief and terrible acceleration, the improbable buoyancy, and then the moment when, godlike, you see the way things fit together, the grave and earnest roads with their little cars, stitching their desires with invisible thread, the tiny pushpin houses and backyard swimming pools dreaming the same blue dream. And who but the dead may look down with impunity on these white birds strewn like dice above a river whose name you have forgotten, though you know, having crossed the divide, that it flows east now, toward the vast, still heartland, its pinstriped remnants of wheat and corn laid out like burial clothes. And how you would like to close your eyes, if only you could stop thinking about that small scratch on the window, more of a pinprick, really, and about yourself sucked out, anatomized, part of you now, the best part, a molecule of pure oxygen, breathed in by the farmer on his tractor, by the frightened rabbit in the ditch, by a child riding a bike in Topeka, by the sad wife of a Mexican diplomat, by a dog digging up a bone 100 years in the future, that foreign city where you don't know a soul, but where you think you could start over, could make a whole new life for yourself, and will. Meditation from 14a by Jennifer Meyer, from her collection Dark Alphabet, published by Southern Illinois University Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Sponsored by Constant Contact, celebrating the launch of Social Campaigns, a brand new social media marketing tool. Learn more at constantcontact.com. Produced by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Tonight, Juan Cole will discuss Arab Spring 1 year later at the University of Arkansas Global Campus Auditorium on the Fayetteville Square at 7. Cole is an author, Middle East expert, and the man behind the blog Informed Comment. Earlier today, he visited KUAF.
Elections are scheduled in Libya this summer. If they're pulled off, it's certainly the case that the religious parties will do well there as well. In my view, it is Muslim fundamentalist politics with a difference, which is that in the old days, it wasn't clear that those religious parties really had bought in to the Westminster system, to parliamentary politics. And this time, they're the ones who are handling it, and they seem really committed to it.
Juan Cole's interview will air later this week on Ozarks at Large. He speaks tonight at 7 at the University of Arkansas Global Campus Auditorium on the Fayetteville Square. This is KUAF 91.3 FM Fayetteville. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Iti Agnihotri Madholkar. Thanks for listening. Stay warm and have a great week.